content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated July 19/July 26, 2021. As usual, the border of the front cover is in red. Time, the word, is superimposed in very large white block letters, this time upon a black and white photograph. Alongside the Time logo is another logo, and that says Olympic Review in small white lettering. It has the five interlocked rings in blue, gold, black, green, and red. The photo is of a young woman of color. Again, it's in black and white. She's wearing a bright white shirt. She is looking at the camera with no expression, really, whatsoever. She's neither smiling nor frowning. Her hair is swept up into some kind of a do in the back. She's wearing drop earrings. I can't determine what the metal color is. The caption reads, "It's okay to not be okay," and it's Naomi Osaka on her first Olympics. Included in this issue of Time are the 40 must-watch Olympians, which we may review a portion of during today's program. Beginning with the brief, there's a photo here of two young people, a man and a woman, dressed casually, standing on an almost white sands beach. But they're behind barricades, and the caption reads, "Looming disaster, the view of a collapsed condo building from the beach in Surfside, Florida, June 30. And beyond the barricades where the couple is standing, there's some greenery, like viney stuff and tall grasses. Beyond that, palm trees. Beyond that, a couple of tall buildings. And in between the tall buildings, which may be condos, it looks like there are wraparound balconies on these multi-story buildings, there is a smashed building. And that would be the collapsed condo. One sees, oh, the concrete is in shambles. The rebar is dangling everywhere. Here, that ruin still remains several feet tall. In fact, a few stories tall. And its details are actually not visible in this camera shot because there's a lower building obscuring the view. This is the brief opener. It is headlined, "Nation Condo Collapse Raises Fears of Climate Risk," by Vera Bergengruen, Surfside, Florida, and Justin Warland, Washington. Ever since the deadly collapse of a condo tower in Surfside, Florida, residents of Miami's waterfront have found themselves looking up more often. Cracks in garage ceilings, corroded rebar in concrete columns, and signs of saltwater seepage after bad weather, not uncommon features of older seaside buildings in this part of the state, are being viewed with new and wary eyes. They have been documented on social media, distributed on group chats, and shared in unnerved emails to building managers and inspectors. The June 24 collapse of the 13-story Champlain Towers South building, just north of Miami Beach, has not only left 46 people confirmed dead, and that number, of course, is from this publication and not current, more than 94 still missing as of July 7. It's also shaken Miami residents who had grown used to natural disasters and regular warnings that they are in the crosshairs of climate change. But this feels different, they say, and experts warn that fresh sense of panic could shake years of breakneck growth in Miami real estate and threaten a regional economy that depends on a robust real estate sector. Already, two other condo buildings on Miami Beach have been evacuated after closer inspections revealed safety concerns, leaving hundreds of residents displaced over a holiday weekend. July 4, what remained of the Surfside building was demolished in a controlled explosion as a tropical storm approached South Florida. I think this just makes the coast a lot less valuable, says Jesse Keenan, an associate professor at Tulane University, who's led research on climate change and financial risk. That value plays out in the market. It plays out in public finance. It plays out in people's perception of what it means to move to Florida. For people living on Florida's coast, waking up with an ocean view has long come with calculated risk. From June to November, homes can be battered by hurricane-force winds that drive occupants to evacuate inland. It is not unusual for people to wade through knee-deep water to get to their cars after heavy rain, or watch U.S. Army Corps of Engineers trucks dumps tens of thousands of tons of fresh sand to replenish the beaches that serve as a buffer from the rising water. The city of Miami, population 470,000, is home to 26% of all U.S. homes at risk from rising seas, according to real estate site Zillow. Studies by the Risky Business Project, a nonpartisan climate change research initiative, suggest $15 billion to $23 billion of property in Florida could be underwater by 2050. There are two photos here for which I will stop. Another photo of a high-rise building. This is more of a close-up, so I can't determine how many stories it includes, but there are tall palm trees in front of it. In front of the palm trees is a tall fence, a tall chain-link fence. It's probably 12 feet high because there are people standing all along the fence, again, casually dressed and observed by the camera from their backs. Many are holding umbrellas, and the sidewalk does look wet. Standing in front of the onlookers and facing the camera, although not looking at it, is an officer. He is wearing a badge. He's dressed in tan and brown. I'm unable to read the badge from here to know what jurisdiction he represents. It's an officer standing guard as people take photos of Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava and Miami Heat player Udonis Haslam, June 30, at a memorial wall for victims of the Champlain Tower South collapse. There's another photo just below it, also in color. It's a blue horizon. It's actually in shades of blue because the top is sky blue. Beneath that, edging the horizon, is blue-green of the ocean. And then closer to the front, to the foreground, is more beach, which is the tawny white tan sand. Across the beach, cutting straight across it, are more of these white, they look like plastic, but they're probably quite substantial, barriers. There's more sand just in front of the barrier upon which is drawn in the sand a heart. Flowers are attached to barriers on the beach near the site of the building collapse, June 30, reads the caption. Returning to the text, But that was supposed to happen gradually, and real estate agents have continued to flog the sunny Florida dream. The pandemic drove the local market to record highs. From May 2020 to May 2021, sales of existing condos jumped 286%, according to the Miami Association of Realtors. It remains to be seen what role, if any, climate-related conditions played in the Champlain Towers collapse, but the event has brought into sharp focus concerns about whether Miami's real estate market can sustain its pace of growth, as the region is increasingly vulnerable to the effects of climate change, and with questions arising about what that means for the safety of people's homes today. Before, when you hired an inspector to inspect your condo, you would never think the building could just fall, says Miami real estate analyst Anna Bozovic. It just doesn't happen. That's crazy. The immediate aftershocks have created a raft of investigations and audits meant to reassure anxious residents. June 26, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava ordered, that's C-A-V-A, the last name, ordered a review of all buildings in the county that are five stories or taller and constructed more than 40 years ago. The Champlain Towers condos were built in 1981, before Florida's building codes were strengthened after Hurricane Andrew devastated the area in 1992. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, a federal agency that investigated the collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11, has dispatched researchers to the site. The town of Surfside has also hired a leading structural engineer to analyze what caused the collapse and determine if the nearby buildings are at risk. The tragedies also brought attention to the mismanagement and lack of transparency apparent in some Florida condo associations. Infighting among condo board members over the astronomical cost to fix buildings has often deferred necessary maintenance. Residents of Champlain Tower South were looking at $15 million, that's $15 million, in assessments to repair major structural damage flagged by engineers in a 2018 report, with owners being asked to pay between roughly $80,000 and $336,000 per unit. Stopping again for a couple of more colored photos, top right, search and rescue efforts resume the day after the demolition of the remaining part of Champlain Towers South, July 5. Well, there are just a lot of workers here, mostly in blue coveralls, wearing yellow helmets. They have dumpsters on site, a big yellow dumpster, and there's also a big implement on trackers. It's like a caterpillar, but not a huge caterpillar as would be used in earth-moving schemes for large buildings. There's another crane or something that I see only a portion of. In the background, there are trees. One palm tree, not far from this rubble. This pile of rubble is taller than the individuals, people working amongst it. One of the palm trees is all dusty, like it's covered with cement dust. But perched atop this pile of rubble that is probably 1.5 times the height of the average person standing near it is a dog. The dog is the only one looking at the camera. It's a large black German Shepherd. Returning to the text, whoops, there's another photo here, and it's mostly flowers. Some of them are wilted. There are pink and yellow and white flowers, roses, daisies, other things that I can't identify. But intermingled with these flowers, which are undoubtedly attached to fencing or some other type of porous material, photographs. Photographs of the missing residents of that condo. Returning to the text, experts say it may take months before clues emerge in publicly reported data on what effects the collapse will have on real estate in the long term. In the coming weeks and months, buyers may be reluctant to choose condos in older buildings located on the ocean's edge, out of concern they may have some of the same issues as Champlain Towers, leaving owners to sell at a steep discount or take their property off the market. In the medium term, insurance companies may decide to reprice their policies for oceanside condos, raising costs and likely decreasing value. In a region where much of the population and the tax base is in close proximity to the waterfront, this devaluation could have a ripple effect, drying up public coffers in a state where 30% of local government revenue comes from property taxes. For years, experts have warned South Florida is vulnerable to a climate-related real estate devaluation. Before Brian Deese, that's D-E-E-S-E, joined the Biden administration as head of the National Economic Council, he told Time the region faced the possibility of a housing shock as awareness of climate risk grows. Physical risks are not being appropriately priced in, Deese said in January 2020. The degree of capital reallocation and the speed of that is going to be larger and happen more quickly than most market participants expect. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. For now, the specter of oceanfront homes disappearing underwater remains distant. Condominium associations are reassuring residents the factors in their buildings vary drastically and that they should have peace of mind, according to emails seen by Time. And as far as the market goes, demand in Miami was so high, it can survive a small dip following a one-off event, if that is what the Surfside disaster proves to be. But the sudden wake-up call to the tangible and deadly consequences of ignoring costly inspections, maintenance, and necessary repairs on the waterfront will inevitably lead some to conclude their Florida dream is simply not worth it. The fear is very real, says Bozovic, the real estate analyst. The older condo buildings dotting the beach may be hit hard in the short term, especially those around the site of the collapse, which she says new buyers will avoid. People died there. Who wants to look at that? It's very sad. Here's a short article under the heading Economy. Heatwave offers preview of climate business losses. There's a very small inset photo here with a dark background. It's probably a door. And upon the door, or whatever it is, the surface, is posted a note on a white piece of paper taped to the surface in masking tape. And it reads, it's written, it looks to me like it's written in hand printing. We will be closing at 3 p.m. today due to the heat. We apologize for any inconvenience. THX, perhaps thanks, with a smiley face. The caption reads, too hot to handle. A business in Portland, Oregon, closed early June 27. Portland, Oregon food cart co-owners Eric and Nicole Gittenstein did not have much choice about whether to open for business during the unexpected recent heat waves plaguing the Pacific Northwest. Excess heat from their refrigerators and burners often raises temperatures inside their cart 10 to 15 degrees higher than those outside, with area temperatures peaking at 116 degrees Fahrenheit, June 28. Working in such conditions could well have put their lives in danger. It is better to lose a weekend than to lose your life. or to be hospitalized for heat exhaustion, Eric Gittenstein says. His fears were warranted. The heat wave is believed to have been responsible for more than 100 deaths in Oregon alone, as of July 7, officials say. While more than 1,100 people across Oregon and Washington state were hospitalized with symptoms of overheating. The record-breaking temperatures have also exacted a serious economic toll, with businesses across the region, many still recovering from coronavirus shutdowns, closing their doors, many to keep their employees safe. It just seemed incredibly unsafe to ask anybody to work, says Kathy Wims, owner of Nostrana, an Italian restaurant in Portland. We could not possibly do that with any good conscience. As the planet continues to warm, business losses across the U.S. are also likely to mount. Up to 1.8 billion workforce hours, or about 11 on-the-clock hours per U.S. worker, could be lost annually within the next three decades because of extreme heat caused by climate change, according to research published in February in the scientific journal Climatic Change. Concerns surrounding extreme heat as a worsening effect of climate change are beginning to make the rounds in Congress. In March, Democrats introduced legislation in both chambers that would direct the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to set new rules meant to protect workers from dangerously hot conditions, like mandating paid cool-down breaks for employees working in high temperatures. Those measures are particularly important for agricultural workers who often spend long hours working in extreme heat conditions. At least one farm worker, Sebastian Francisco Perez, 38, was killed in the Pacific Northwest's heat wave. June 29, the United Farm Workers and Agricultural Union urged Washington Governor Jay Inslee to implement emergency standards to protect workers from excessive heat. If the economic impacts of extreme heat are a threat for the U.S., they may be much worse in parts of the world without the resources and institutions to mitigate the growing problem. In the long run, rich places, as they get hotter, will spend money to adapt, says Bob Kopp, K-O-P-P, director of the Rutgers Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. That option is not available to people in much of the rest of the world. And even the best efforts may not help the U.S. escape all the economic consequences of extreme heat, which could knock $170 billion off the country's GDP by 2100, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. For individuals, that could mean lower paychecks and new medical bills. For businesses, it is lost revenue on top of already thin margins. Eric Gittenstein, for instance, says the day's loss to the heat wave badly hurt Portland's food carts, which have to make sales during the crucial summer months in order to get through the winter season. It is one thing for this to be a random occurrence, Gittenstein says. If this is the norm, that is going to destroy our income. And that article was written by Alejandro de la Garza. For the record, I do not want to win someone else's game, stated by Nicole Hannah-Jones, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist who created the 1619 Project, announcing July 6 she was declining a tenured position at the University of North Carolina, offered after an outcry over its trustees' earlier refusal to consider her for the appointment. She instead accepted a position at Howard University. It is very quiet. The other horses know. Jerry Gilbert said, the owner of Big Jake, the world's tallest horse, in a July 5 interview with local news channel WMTV after Big Jake's death at the age of 20. 82. age of Mary Wallace Wally Funk, F-U-N-K, who underwent astronaut training in 1961 as part of the canceled Mercury 13 Woman in Space program and will travel with Jeff Bezos to space July 20 aboard a rocket made by his company, Blue Origin. Don't judge me because I am human. I just happen to run a little faster. Sha'Carri Richardson, American sprinter, speaking on the Today Show July 2, after her suspension from the U.S. Olympic team after testing positive for THC. We will fully support our producers and their excellence. Long live French champagne. Franck Riester, French trade minister, in a July 5 tweet addressing a new Russian law banning foreign producers of sparkling wine from using the term champagne, even those in the French region from which the name originates. The most important thing is that my people are free, free from the invaders. Deborah Chion, Gebre Michael, leader of the Tigray region in Ethiopia, in a July 3 interview with the New York Times after his guerrilla forces retook the city of Mekelle from Ethiopian troops stationed there since last fall. Good news of the week, trials run in Iceland from 2015 to 2019 found that reducing the work week from 40 hours to around 35 hours without lowering pay was an overwhelming success with no productivity loss, researchers said July 4, and 146,000 years minimum age of a fossilized skull of an ancient human found in northern China, nicknamed Dragon Man, scientists announced June 25. The brief news postcard: do Duterte's threats make the Philippines safer from COVID-19? Duterte, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, is spelled D-U-T-E-R-T-E. This is written by Ai Balogtasay Manila. Nurse Delta Santiago has reached the top of her field. She works in one of the best hospitals in the Philippines, frequented by billionaires and celebrities. But the 32-year-old cannot wait to leave. Santiago, who has to go by a pseudonym because of potential backlash from her employer, is concerned about the risk of bringing COVID-19 home from the hospital to her family. Because of the pandemic, authorities have imposed strict curbs on public transport, making her 15-mile commute a time-consuming ordeal. So for the past 8 months, she's been sleeping in a hospital utility room, just steps from the plush private medical suites, where high-paying patients recline in relative comfort. There, on a thin mattress spread between rolls of garbage bags and toilet disinfectant, an exhausted Santiago has video calls with her 8-year-old son, whom she rarely sees in person. She sees with fury at what she says is the needless suffering the pandemic has brought to the Philippines. The Southeast Asian country of 109 million people was already struggling to contain COVID-19 when numbers began to climb sharply in March. Typical daily caseloads have ranged from 3,000 to 7,000 over the past 3 months, but have peaked as high as 11,000. Total COVID-19 deaths have doubled, rising from 12,300 on March 1 to nearly 25,000 at the start of July. Experts say those figures are almost certainly undercounts. like Narendra Modi's India or Jair Bolsonaro's Brazil, the Philippines is ruled by a medical populist in President Rodrigo Duterte, says physician and medical anthropologist Gideon Lasco. It's a term Lasco coined to describe how authoritarian leaders have responded to the public health crisis, making belittling threats, maligning data, and proffering improvised solutions. Duterte's approach has been to put the Philippines on a war footing, Lasco says, which is part of a deliberate pattern of spectacle. The president appears on TV to give COVID-19 updates, flanked by top military brass. Lockdown orders in place across the archipelago since March 2020 are enforced by armed security personnel in a manner described by UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet in April as highly militarized. Duterte has himself told police to kill anti-lockdown protesters who resist arrest. The president has recently started espousing vaccinations as the country's way out of the pandemic, but achieving herd immunity anytime soon looks highly unlikely, as vaccine hesitancy is deep-rooted. Less than 3% of the population was fully vaccinated by early July. So more intimidation could be in the cards. June 21, Duterte threatened to lock up anyone refusing a COVID-19 shot. "You choose, vaccine or I will have you jailed," he warned on television. From a short column entitled "World Out of Step," and one sees here pavement with 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 8 pairs of feet, all in black high heels, and all clad, we see only from the feet to the knees, in camouflage trousers. Written by Madeline Carlisle, women in the Ukrainian military will wear high heels as they march in an upcoming parade marking the 30th anniversary of the country's independence from the Soviet Union, officials said July 1. Sparking an outcry from lawmakers who labeled the decision sexist. Here, other occasions when military style has brought people to attention. 3 more little items. Bronzed medals. Viral footage of an October 2020 Police Academy graduation ceremony in Cairo showed hundreds of buff and shirtless police recruits posing and flexing on a procession of cars, boats, and armored trucks. Splitting hairs. The U.S. Army announced May 6, female soldiers can now wear ponytails and braids while in uniform. Many soldiers had complained the previously required bun made it difficult to wear helmets, I would think. Wedge issues. Photos of a North Korean Border Patrol unit received much attention in 2013 for appearing to show female soldiers marching in 4-inch platform heels along the banks of the Yalu River in the town of Senuiju. From NewsTicker, 3 short items. Eswatini forces fire on protesters, and that may be pronounced Eswatini. Ongoing anti-monarchy protests in the Kingdom of Eswatini in southern Africa were met with gunshots and tear gas that left dozens dead or injured, according to reports. The UN said July 6 it was deeply concerned and called on security forces to exercise utmost restraint. Oil leak in Gulf of Mexico sparks fire. A 12-inch leak in an underwater gas pipe in the Gulf of Mexico created a raging fire July 2 that burned on the ocean surface for over 5 hours. Pemex, P-E-M-E-X, the Mexican oil company that controls the pipeline, said the fire was created after lightning struck gas that had risen to the surface. Trump org and senior exec charged. New York prosecutors charged the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, with tax-related crimes July 1. The first criminal charges resulting from the years-long investigation of the former president's business, Weisselberg pleaded not guilty, and Trump called the charges a witch hunt. From the brief milestones released, Bill Cosby conviction overturned by Janelle Ross. After Pennsylvania's Supreme Court June 30 freed Bill Cosby from the state prison where he'd been held since being convicted of sexual assault in 2018, the disgraced comedian was quick to offer himself as an exemplar of the problem of wrongful convictions. But the court's decision to free him on a procedural matter included no findings of innocence. Procedural claims are a powerful tool for people who are wrongfully convicted, but those people tend to be unable to afford the kind of legal team Cosby had, notes Samuel Gross, a co-founder of the National Registry of Exonerations. Cases like Cosby's are as similar to other trials as a high school football game in the Super Bowl. There's a small inset photo here of a really elderly-looking Bill Cosby. It shows just his face. He's wearing a white T-shirt, it looks like, and his hair is very short and gray, and he is photographed against a black background. Now, here's a black-and-white photograph, and it's taken in the Oval Office of the White House in September 1974. It shows Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld, White House Chief of Staff speaking with President Gerald Ford. Ford is seated at his desk, and Rumsfeld is leaning on the desk and speaking to the president. The heading here is Died. Donald Rumsfeld led U.S. troops into the known unknown. Had he only a single stint as U.S. Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld would likely be remembered as a wunderkind who, under President Gerald Ford in the 1970s, became the youngest man ever to run the Pentagon. But Rumsfeld, who died June 30 at 88, is best known instead for his second go-round as President George W. Bush's defense chief and for his role as the architect of the nation's problem-plagued war on terrorism. Finding someone in Washington who's indifferent about Rumsfeld's legacy is a near impossibility. To a few, he is a crafty bureaucratic knife fighter who spent four decades rising to the highest offices in government. To everyone else, he is an acerbic, argumentative leader who set the U.S. in motion toward unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Wars that are only now, some 20 years later, beginning to come to an end. Although Rumsfeld repeatedly stoked fears over Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction ahead of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, he refused to accept blame when the arsenal never materialized. His decision to maintain a light footprint of U.S. forces in the country is believed to have helped foster conditions that led to violent insurgency and the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis. And he was later pilloried for the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and detainees at Guantanamo Bay. This all contributed to Rumsfeld's eventual resignation in 2006. It marked the end of a tenure in stark contrast to his work for Ford, when he was widely seen as a reformer, leading initiatives that ultimately helped end the Cold War. That record, however, was eclipsed long ago. That was written by W.J. Hennigan. A few more brief milestones listed here. Died Bollywood actor and producer Dilip Kumar at 98, July 7. Hoanani K. Trask, a leader of the Hawaiian Sovereignty Movement at 71, July 3. Spiked oil prices July 6 to their highest level in 6 years after OPEC, Russia, and other oil-producing allies failed to reach a deal on production. halted U.S. federal executions, the Attorney General said July 1, for a review of policies after the Trump administration executed a record 13 people. Sentenced Belarusian opposition leader Viktor Barbarenko to 14 years in prison July 6 on corruption charges his supporters say were fabricated. One, WON, the Miss Nevada USA title by Cataluna Enrique, June 27, making her the first openly trans woman set to compete in the Miss USA pageant. Arrested, a spectator at the Tour de France, June 30, whose cardboard sign caused a massive bike crash during the race's first leg 4 days earlier. Released, the Ever Given cargo ship, July 7, after authorities reached a settlement over its blockage of the Suez Canal in March. Here's a piece on the Tokyo Olympics with those five interlocking rings, the logo. A game like no other, or it really says a games like no other. The Pandemic Games, Tokyo Attempts to Avoid Disaster by Alice Park. The Olympics and COVID-19 were never going to be compatible. The cardinal rule when it comes to controlling an infectious disease is to limit the contact people have with one another. Yet the very essence of the 2 weeks of competition, which begin July 23 in Tokyo, is to invite the world to meet, greet, and engage in friendly and often not socially distant contests. An estimated 70,000 athletes, coaches, staff, officials, and media will be descending on Tokyo from July to August for the Olympic and Paralympic Games, at a time when infections in the city are beginning to creep up again after spiking in April and May and declining in early June. New cases of COVID-19 emerging from any of the Olympic visitors could not only disrupt the Games, but also forever tarnish this year's Olympics as an exercise in folly amid a global pandemic that has claimed the lives of 4 million people. The worst thing that would happen is that the Olympics becomes a super-spreading event that goes around the world, says Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, who has advised the International Olympic Committee, IOC, and Japanese health officials on COVID-19 countermeasures. Olympic organizers are working desperately to prevent that from happening. After consulting with infectious disease experts from across the globe, Tokyo 2020 officials have created a playbook of guidelines for everyone who will be traveling to Japan for the Olympics. Many of the measures are familiar and proven from the experience of the past year. Frequent testing, mask mandates, social distancing procedures, and creating as much of an isolation bubble for Olympic participants as possible. The strategy is also realistic. While it might not be possible to prevent the virus from infiltrating the Olympic community, the countermeasures are meant to contain it as much as possible. Infections will happen. The challenge lies in minimizing the risk of those infections and the impact they might have on not just the Games, but also the Japanese public and ultimately the world at large when Olympic delegations return home. We have to closely watch how the situation evolves before and during the Games, said Hidemasa Nakamura, the Tokyo Olympic official most deeply involved in coordinating and executing COVID-19 safety measures during the Games. In that sense, I feel that the Olympics and Paralympics are a microcosm of the world. The 2020 Tokyo Games were delayed a year in the hopes that the COVID-19 pandemic would be under control by now. As the Japanese government and the IOC forge ahead with plans to hold the world's largest sporting event, even as infections simmer globally, anti-Olympic sentiment has reached a peak in Japan, with just 14% of Japanese polled in May saying they wanted the games to proceed as scheduled. One of the country's physicians' organizations, the Japan Doctors Union, and a leading newspaper, Asahi Shimbun, argue the risk is not acceptable. An online campaign called Stop Tokyo Olympics has amassed nearly 450,000 signatures so far from around the country. The pushback goes beyond the usual reluctance that citizens of host countries typically express before any Olympics. Public anxiety and medical mandates are clashing with economic pressures and political forces in a showdown that for now is tipping in favor of the financial and political interests to go ahead with the games. Japan's government has been saying it is seeking ways to balance the economy and enforcement of COVID-19 countermeasures, but I think its priority has been the economy, says Kenji Utsunomiya, a former chair of the Japan Federation of Bar Associations and the founder of the Stop Tokyo Olympics campaign. Some public health officials warn of unknowns that could unravel even the best laid plans. Fewer than 15% of the Japanese population are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, and new variants of the virus, which spread more quickly, threaten to dismantle any sense of immune security that the countermeasures are designed to establish. The challenge here is this is an international event where people are coming from all over the world, and you obviously cannot bubble the world and keep the virus from spreading, says Osterholm. The danger of convening thousands during a pandemic is very real. July 3, a Serbian rower tested positive when he arrived at the Tokyo airport and was immediately isolated. He and his teammates were prevented from traveling to the training site. A Ugandan coach among the first Olympic teams to fly in also tested positive at the airport June 19 and was isolated despite two negative tests within 4 days of his flight. The rest of his delegation was allowed to quarantine at their Osaka training site, where another member tested positive. Such cases will likely occur with increasing frequency as more teams arrive and only highlight the knife's edge on which the Olympics will play out. On the one hand, SARS-CoV-2 continues to run rampant around the world and could find fertile ground in the congregation of international visitors. On the other, expected vaccination rates of around 80% for participants and strict countermeasures could rescue the games by containing cases and preventing them from flaring up into major outbreaks. Athletes have been warned that their Olympic experience will be like no other. Their chances for interacting with athletes from other countries will be severely restricted. Condoms, normally a cornerstone of Olympic Village perks, will not be distributed until athletes are checking out, and alcohol will not be served in dining halls. They will be required to wear masks except when they're competing or eating. They will be tested daily, and if they test positive, they will be isolated and likely not allowed to compete. They also will not be able to enjoy one of the hallmark benefits of being an Olympian, roaming the different venues and sitting in the stands to check out unfamiliar sports or cheer on teammates. Athletes will also be missing their family support structure. In March, the Tokyo Organizing Committee banned international fans, including families of athletes, from attending the games. And with a month to go before the opening ceremony, officials announced they would allow domestic spectators at only 50% capacity, with no more than 10,000 at any venue. IOC President Thomas Bach has promised that the Tokyo Games will be safe from COVID-19, but the reality is there can be no truly safe Olympics, only a safer one. Experts agree there are no zero-risk scenarios, yet the actual risk to athletes, Japanese citizens, and the rest of the world has never been properly calculated or communicated. As far as I know, there's no risk assessment report or result, says Hitoshi Oshitani, the virologist who helped devise Japan's COVID-19 strategy. So we do not have any concrete material to judge if the risk is acceptable for Japan and for other countries. He argues that only after such an evaluation can a decision be made about whether it's safe to hold the games. Instead, Tokyo Olympics organizers and Japan health officials have focused on detection and containment to make it harder for the virus to spread among the Olympic community. And if it does, to pick up cases before they spark clusters or even outbreaks that could spill over into the local population. Any athlete, coach, or trainer who tests positive will be immediately placed into isolation in a designated area in the Olympic Village Clinic. Patients who develop symptoms and require longer quarantine will move to a hotel dedicated to COVID-19 cases. And for people who need more intensive medical care, up to 30 hospitals across Tokyo stand ready to accept Olympic participants. However, a spokesperson at St. Luke's International Hospital, which is listed as the medical center assigned to care for the athletes, says while it's been approached to coordinate care as of late June, there's been no progress since. Some public health experts say the greatest danger of spread, however, may come from the tens of thousands of Japanese citizens who will be watching the events as spectators. That risk is amplified by the increasing prevalence of the Delta variant, which Japanese health experts predict could account for half of new infections in the country by mid-July. Because it is considerably more contagious and can potentially cause more severe disease than earlier forms of the virus. To minimize that threat, Olympic organizers are enforcing stricter testing and quarantine requirements for athletes and team staff arriving from more than a dozen countries where the Delta variant is dominant, like India, the UK, and Malaysia. Fewer than 30% of healthcare workers in Tokyo are vaccinated, meaning they might pass along new infections to their families and communities if they were to get infected through their Olympic work. While Japanese athletes are vaccinated, in part using shots donated by Pfizer-BioNTech, volunteers have not been offered the same protection. Such inequity has been a recurring theme in the public perspective of the Olympics, a sense that, driven by economic rather than public health priorities, the Olympic community arriving from abroad is being favored over Japanese citizens. The government of Japan should have aimed to have the majority of its people vaccinated, at least by the end of March this year, if it sought to be fully prepared to host the Games, says Utsunomiya, citing one reason he started the petition to cancel the Olympics. Our campaign reflects the voices of people who've been struggling with the pandemic situation. It is only natural people are not in a mood to welcome the games and be festive. Whether those feelings change once the competition begins will largely depend on how well participants comply with testing protocols and movement restrictions. No matter how well the playbooks are designed, whether people abide by the rule is a different story, says Dr. Nobuhiko Okabe, who chairs a panel of independent experts that's been advising the Japanese government on ways to control COVID-19 during the games. If they violate those rules, athletes can be fined, pulled from competing, or deported. And presumably, even with these punitive measures, athletes are motivated to follow the rules so they don't get infected and jeopardize years of training. That is what Olympic organizers and the people of Japan are counting on, but the reality is that no one can predict what will happen during the 3 weeks the world's attention is trained on Tokyo. In past history, nobody's had Olympics during a pandemic, so we don't know what will happen, says Oshitani. That's the big challenge for everyone. This article was slightly abridged and written by Alice Park with reporting by Mayako Shibata, Tokyo, and Leslie Dickstein. A photo accompanies this article. It's a crowd of people. Most that I can see are wearing masks, except I cannot see the faces of all of them because they're holding signs. Each person is holding a sign. They are replicates of one another in big red, and these are all written in English, cancel in red, and then below that in black, the Tokyo Olympics. Cancel the Tokyo Olympics. The caption reads, nearly 450,000 people signed an online petition to cancel the games. And there's another photo here. It's actually the Tokyo skyline at night. So there are lots of skyscrapers and other buildings all lit against the night sky, which is very dark blue. There's a bridge with lighting on it in blue, an office tower in red, and the five interlocking rings of the Olympic logo in white, apparently affixed to a building across a river from which several people stand. There's railing between them and the water. The caption reads, host city pride is turning to apprehension as COVID-19 cases rise. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.